Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from Space Beans Coffee, committed to fueling the daily journey from morning grogginess to the peak of productivity, offering a variety of brews, including Go for Launch, Dark Side of the Moon, Rocket to Mars, and more. Available at their Melbourne cafe or online at spacebeans.com.
The latest news from the Space Beat, plus moon experiments go for a spin. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, a radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Boeing announced its intention to lay off over 400 employees working on NASA's Space Launch System, or SLS. Boeing is the prime contractor for the core stage of the rocket that will take humans to the moon. As the Trump administration targets cuts within the agency, where does that leave SLS? And what about Boeing's Starliner? Ars Technica's senior editor Eric Berger has been following these stories and more and joins us to answer those questions. Then one plant enthusiast has taken his green thumb to space, to the edge of space, that is, and took it for a spin. We'll speak with Florida Tech's John Z. Kiss about his lunar experiment. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Boeing is the primary contractor for the core stage of SLS, a rocket that's intended to be used in the upcoming human moon missions and landings for NASA's Artemis program. But Boeing recently announced intentions of laying off over 400 employees related to the program, and Boeing is facing additional scrutiny over its Starliner capsule, which returned to Earth without its maiden crew. Here to talk more about Boeing and the aerospace company's future is Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica. Eric, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Brennan. It's great to be back.
Good to have you as well, Eric. Lots to talk about when it comes to Boeing. I want to start with Boeing's announcements of layoffs related to the Space Launch System. What do we know about this?
They're being very careful in their messaging. But what we know for sure is that last Friday, Boeing called together the SLS team. It was a remote meeting. And the manager spoke for about 5 minutes and said that they were, you know, potentially going to have to lay off people, about half of the workforce, 400 people, and reassign others on the SLS team because they weren't sure NASA was going to renew the contracts for the Space Launch System rocket. That's all we really know for sure.
Is there indication that NASA will not renew those contracts?
Well, one of the interesting facets of this is that this meeting caught NASA unawares. NASA headquarters did not know about it. They were shocked when mine and a few other stories started appearing Friday afternoon and Friday evening reporting on this. And NASA put out a statement on Saturday saying that they're reconsidering everything, but they're committed to the Space Launch System rocket and their agreements with Boeing and other legacy contractors.
This could be pure speculation, Eric, but do you know where that concern on Boeing's behalf is coming from?
Well, there's a couple of different theories, but I think, first of all, you have to start with the fact that there's no question that the incoming Trump administration is taking another look at the Artemis architecture, right? Artemis 2, fly around the moon. Artemis 3, land on the moon with SLS, Orion, and Starship. And they're, you know, they're giving some consideration to flying Artemis 2 and Artemis 3 on Orion and SLS, potentially canceling one or both of those programs, or, you know, keeping everything as is for a while. And I think Boeing is responding to some of the uncertainty. I think the biggest immediate concern from Boeing's perspective involves the exploration upper stage, or EUS. This is the more powerful upper stage. It's going to go on the Space Launch System rocket, beginning supposedly with Artemis 4. And this is something I think that is going to be fairly low-hanging fruit for the Trump administration to cancel. And I think this was a way of Boeing's kind of getting out in front of that and saying, hey, if you do cancel this and Congress doesn't save it, you know, we are going to cut these jobs.
What happens if that gets canceled? I mean, that doesn't allow Orion to get to the moon, right?
No. Orion can get to the moon with the Block 1 version of the SLS okay. rocket. Basically, exploration upper stage allows you to do something called co-manifest, or basically bring large payloads along for the ride. So I think if we're being realistic, EUS does two things. First of all, it allows NASA to build a lunar gateway because you can bring your station modules out to lunar orbit and then have astronauts and Orion sort of assemble the space station or the station out there. But more realistically, this was just another contract for Boeing to kind of keep the SLS program going in terms of development funding and the ability to continue to push money toward Boeing and Marshall and Stennis Space Center in Mississippi.
Gotcha. And so that would take Gateway off the table then, right?
So I think Gateway probably is coming off the table, or at the very least, there's going to be an appetite to build it, construct it somewhere else. No one really likes the near rectilinear halo orbit, which we can get into why the station is there, but we don't have to. It's kind of complicated. You know, potentially you could even see that station being built in low Earth orbit or low lunar orbit or being canceled.
So, I mean, it has always been speculated that SLS could be canceled. I mean, for years now, and it looks like this is getting more and more of a possibility. What does that mean for Artemis overall, if that in fact is the case?
Well, all of this is in NASA's parlance in the trade space right now. The reality is that probably the quickest way to get humans to the moon would be to fly Artemis 2 and Artemis 3 on SLS and Orion, since the rocket exists, however expensive as it is, and Orion, you know, exists as well. But there's a real, you know, at the same time, we've got the Department of Government Efficiency, we've got a desire to cut waste in the U.S. government, and let's be honest, spending $4 billion a year on a rocket and ground systems that the private industry can build faster, better, cheaper, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So there's a debate going on right now within senior levels of NASA and within the Trump administration about whether to cut their losses on SLS or, you know, with a sunk cost fallacy or press ahead and fly the rocket for a little while longer. And you know, all of my sources indicate that decision has not yet been made.
The Department of Government Efficiency, run by Elon Musk, who we know is the founder and CEO of SpaceX. Eric, are you surprised that he hasn't taken aim at this yet? I mean, you would think this is would be one of the first things that Musk would come after.
Well, it's all very tangled, isn't it? Because SpaceX builds the best rockets in the world, and now their boss is running space policy, so to speak, in addition to the rest of the government. So there's conflicts of interest across the board to deal with. The reality is, though, I don't think Elon Musk got into politics for space policy reasons. I think he got into politics because he wanted power and he was upset about some things. And so he spent a lot of money to get really close to the next president of the United States and was successful in that. He has been involved at NASA to some extent. He's been at headquarters at least one time since the election, but I think he's got bigger fish to fry right now than space policy.
Let's talk about one of the people that will be getting into space policy that does have a SpaceX connection. That's Jared Isaacman. He's been nominated to be the next NASA administrator. What do we know about Isaacman and what he may potentially do when it comes to Artemis when he's in office, if he is confirmed?
Yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of unease, a lot of, I think people who work at NASA right now the morale is pretty low, right? And so they really could use a leader. And there is generally, I think, hope that Isaacman, who's a pilot, who's a businessman, who's flown to space twice on Dragon vehicles, and who is very well regarded by almost everyone who's run across him, is a very likable person who generally tries to do the right thing, will bring some stability to NASA and help set the policy for the future. When all that happens and what happens is, again, I hate to come back to the word complicated, but Ted Cruz is now chair of the committee that's going to conduct that hearing. He's been noncommittal on when that hearing is going to be. I think he wants to have a hand in space policy. So there's going to be some dance between Janet Petro, the acting administrator of NASA, the White House, and Ted Cruz on some of the SLS and Artemis stuff we just talked about, and when and where Isaacman's confirmation hearing takes place. And you know, he really at this point is kind of doesn't have a say in policy because he's not confirmed. He's kind of laying low until he gets confirmed.
Yeah, complicated indeed. Another complicated issue I want to chat with you about is Boeing's Starliner, which returned without a crew. What does the future look like for Boeing's Starliner capsule? What do we know about that?
Well, it's really interesting. It's, you know, it came back at the end of September. There was, you know, NASA ultimately took Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams off the spacecraft because it had some concerns about the propulsion system. But it's been months and months and months since Starliner came back safely. And Boeing has really not said anything publicly about the future of the vehicle. Now, I'm hearing a couple of things. First of all, I'm hearing that Boeing is pressing ahead with all the work it needs to do to understand the problems with the propulsion system and the helium leak and other issues with that crewed flight last summer. So they are continuing to at least demonstrate to NASA that they're committed to the contract, although publicly they have not said, as I said, anything. Secondly, I think there's a pretty good chance the next flight of Starliner, if it happens, will be a cargo flight to the International Space Station rather than carrying crew. I've made some inquiries to NASA over the last couple of weeks about that. I've been hearing some things, but so far they haven't confirmed anything.
Let's talk about the plan to bring Butch and Sonny home, who did fly up on that first Starliner flight. Their ride came back home uncrewed, as you mentioned. SpaceX is now charged with bringing them back. Where do we stand with that mission?
Well, they're going to come back in March now, a few weeks earlier than was kind of previously the plan. And it's unfortunately, this has really gotten political. The President Trump and Elon Musk both sort of stepped in it and said that the astronauts on the space station effectively were stranded and that SpaceX was going to have to go rescue them. You know, those of us in the space community know that that's really not true. The Crew Dragon vehicle that is going to bring them home has been docked to the space station for months and months. So they could really come home at any time. The issue has been getting a replacement crew, this Crew 10 mission, up to the space station. And they were supposed to fly in a new Crew Dragon vehicle. And that vehicle had some battery issues during processing. And so it's just not ready. And it probably won't be ready until late April. So they're going to swap out vehicles. All that to say that the Crew 10 is now going to launch no earlier than March 12th. And then about a week later, Crew 9, including Butch and Sonny, can come home. What I think is going to happen is that the president and Elon are going to stand up when they get back and say, look, we rescued them, you know, after the Biden administration stranded them, and kind of try to make this a bit of a political circus. But the reality is that NASA has had this issue well in hand for months. And you know, this plan to swap the Crew Dragon vehicles has been in work since before Trump came into office.
And finally, Eric, you know, we are in a new year here, 2025. Any particular missions or milestones that you're most excited for or keeping a watchful eye on this year?
You know, there's not a lot of super exciting launches this year, especially with Artemis 2 being pushed at least into April of next year. I think for the next several months, really the most fascinating thing for me is going to be space policy, just to see what happens with Artemis and where what Isaacman does when he comes in. I will say there is going to be lots of interesting activity around the moon. Obviously, Firefly just launched a couple of weeks ago, and their Blue Ghost lander is getting toward the moon. Intuitive Machines has a very exciting launch coming up at the end of February with their second lander. They've got some really cool stuff on that mission, including a hopper that's going to basically hop across the lunar surface into a permanently shadowed region to see what's down there, what kind of ice is down there. And then Blue Origin says by the end of the year, it's going to launch its Blue Moon Mark 1 lander to the moon. Now, this is really a massive vehicle. It would be by far the largest lander anyone has sent to the moon since Apollo. If you've been in their headquarters, you may have seen it. I mean, that thing is huge. That's very exciting, too. So there's going to be lots of action on the moon in addition to the space policy halls of Washington, D.C.
And I know you will be keeping a watchful eye over it, Eric. Eric Berger is the senior space editor at Ars Technica. He's also the author of two books, Liftoff, about the rise of SpaceX, and Reentry, on the development of the Falcon 9 rocket and Dragon. Eric, thanks so much for bringing us up to speed.
My pleasure, Brendan.
Still to come, the efforts to bring plants to the moon and Mars.
The interesting thing is when we looked at the Martian gravity, now Martian gravity is 3/8 typical 1G on Earth, and there, the plants actually behave like 1G. So there was very little difference between the Martian gravity and Earth. The good news is if we're going to grow plants on Mars, gravity is not going to be an issue. There are lots of other issues, namely radiation.
Making the gray moon and red Mars green. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. Growing up, Joanne Higgins heard her godfather tell all kinds of stories about NASA and space, but it wasn't until decades later she discovered he worked on the Apollo Moon program. Higgins was fascinated with her father's work and went on to interview three men that worked at NASA and on the Moon program. In her four-part series, The Other Moonshot, Higgins tells the stories of these men and what it was like to be a black aerospace engineer while facing racial barriers in the race to the moon. Hear more about that podcast next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about space and plants. Florida Tech's John Z. Kiss wants to grow plants on the moon. His research has reached the space station, but most recently, he's taken his experiments for a spin. In partnership with Blue Origin and For Space, Kiss's experiments launched on Blue's New Shepard capsule, and during the mission, the spacecraft mimicked lunar gravity by spinning. Here to talk more about his experiment and why it could help us grow plants on another planet is John Z. Kiss. He's a plant space biologist, professor, provost, and senior vice president for academic affairs at Florida Tech. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to chat with you. You conducted an experiment recently in lunar gravity, but you did it from here on Earth. How'd you pull that off?
Well, we worked with Blue Origin on one of their suborbital flights in their New Shepard vehicle. It launches from West Texas. And what happened in this mission is the capsule reaches a certain height above the von Karman line, and it's released from the rocket. In past experiments, it went into free fall or microgravity. This time, Blue Origin tried something very clever. They spun the entire capsule. So rather than microgravity, it produced actual lunar gravity, which is 1/6 Earth's G. So it's pretty cool.
So Blue Origin literally took your experiment for a spin.
They did, yes.
John, tell me a bit about what your experiment is and why it's important that you were able to conduct it in this 1/6 gravity that mimics that of gravity on the moon.
It produces the lunar gravity.
Okay.
So I have to take a step back. So I'm a plant biologist. And I've worked with NASA and the European Space Agency for a long time. And I have experience growing plants in microgravity. I'm interested in basic mechanisms of plant development, how plants perceive gravity and light. But it really has implications for long-term space missions like on the moon and Mars, where you need plants there as a food source or to generate oxygen. So I'm used to these experiments, first of all, that are much longer duration. You know, we've grown plants for days in space. We had this opportunity with Blue Origin. And actually, there's an intermediate company called For Space, which sponsors commercial payloads, but tries to piggyback science experiments. So we only had minutes of lunar gravity, actually ended up being 2 minutes, which is not really a great time frame for a direct plant biology experiment. So what we did was my colleagues and I at NASA and University of Louisiana and For Space, we designed an experiment in fluid dynamics. So the questions we asked is, how do fluids behave in lunar gravity? Relevant to the plant biology, because you're going to be watering plants and seeing how fluids interact with the soil. So it's relevant to my longer term goal. And things like fluid dynamics, we know a lot about it on Earth. We actually know things, microgravity, but we don't know very much about what happens to the fluids in lunar gravity.
What did you learn?
What I did learn, though, is we're analyzing the data. It's going to take time. Our data that we got back was videos. We had a small camera on board, and we had videos of fluids of different viscosity, water, glycerol, some other things. And we're going to be looking at that. But what I can tell you is that the experiment worked. So we got the images back. This is the first time that Blue Origin tried this approach of spinning the entire capsule. What we know is that I was kind of concerned whether the lunar gravity would be stable. And we had an accelerometer. So we saw the different gravities during the mission, but the lunar gravity was really stable. It was very clean, 1/6 G. So I'm very excited that the experiment worked, and it'll take us a while to analyze the data. The other thing I might add is, so we're interested in lunar gravity, but we actually had a pretty interesting profile in this mission. So during the ascent, you know, we started with 1 G, but during the ascent, there's some hypergravity. It went up to 5 G. There was a period of microgravity and free fall, and then they start spinning the capsule. So we have a variety of G levels, which actually makes the experiment more valuable.
As a plant space biologist, What are you hoping to learn from this? So are you more interested in how water may permeate through the lunar soil into plants, or how water may move through plants that are growing in a lunar gravity, or both?
The most direct result is going to be the former, is how the water and other kinds of fluids percolate and make their way through the lunar regolith. You know, a secondary goal would be, we need to also understand the fluid dynamics within a plant, because that's very important. One big issue about water relations in plants, so basically the way plants work on Earth is a process called transpiration. So what happens is water is in the root system, and it's actually pulled up through transpiration. So what happens is the water actually evaporates on the surface of leaves. So we want to understand how gravity might affect those processes.
Fascinating. Is this the first time that you're able to take a look at something related to plant biology in lunar gravity? Like, I know there have been studies in microgravity on the International Space Station. You alluded to very long-term studies of growing plants. But like, what do we know about plants growing in 1/6 gravity?
So we've done previous experiments on the ISS where we grew plants and actually at different gravities. We did micro-G, we had a 1G control, and we studied lunar gravity and Martian gravity. So very few people have studied this, but we have a really nice data set. So for the parameters that we studied, the interesting thing is that in some ways it's to be expected, but in other ways it's surprising. So when you look at the parameters we studied, and we looked at phototropic curvature at different gravities, the responses of the plant to light, and that's affected by the different gravities. The plants at lunar gravity pretty much behave like they did at microgravity. So lunar gravity and microgravity, for the parameters that we studied, I always have to say for those parameters, were pretty similar. The interesting thing is when we looked at the Martian gravity, now Martian gravity is 3/8 typical 1G on Earth, and there the plants actually behaved like 1G. So there was very little difference between the Martian gravity and Earth. The good news is if we're going to grow plants on Mars, gravity is not going to be an issue. There are lots of other issues, namely radiation. We need to understand radiation biology, particularly the interaction between radiation and the fractional reduced gravity. However, growing plants on the moon might be more challenging because that behaves like microgravity. And that, in a way, is a nice, so these were ISS experiments where we grew plants from seed to about 6 days. And that's a link to this much shorter fluid dynamics experiment. But it's really important to understand plant biology, really, to go both to Moon and Mars. Most of the talk is, let's build a big rocket. And I think we have the technology to do that. Yes, there'll be challenges, but I think the questions are biological. What happens to humans and plants on these long-term missions? What happens if you're living on Mars in this really, really kind of nasty high radiation environment?
John, you mentioned that there is a need for more of these experiments if we are going to live and work on places like the Moon and Mars in the near future. Experiments in the International Space Station, while you're able to create those gravities, I imagine getting stuff to the International Space Station is, one, very expensive, and two, very exclusive. There's a lot of stuff that wants to go up there in very limited space. With an opportunity like you were presented with Blue Origin's New Shepard and creating that lunar gravity by spinning, does that kind of open up a new avenue of experimentation and understanding for these big biological questions that you want to answer before we do send humans to the Moon and Mars?
I think that these companies, I think they're opening new opportunities. And I think this is very exciting. Now, the New Shepard is suborbital. Even there, you know, there was a if you look on the website, there are like 30 experiments on there funded by NASA and NASA researchers. So yeah, I think the more opportunities we have to do these experiments is going to be good to prepare us for Moon and Mars. I admire these companies. I think they are providing opportunities. The other thing is, so ForSpace, the company I'm working with, the intermediary company, they're really great because they fly all sorts of commercial payloads. And I'm a science advisor to ForSpace, so I'm a little biased. I advise them to do my own experiment. They're committed, ForSpace is committed to provide scientific opportunities for scientists. They're also very interested in the public outreach, the STEM outreach, to encourage, you know, young people to go into STEM fields. And the space program, as you know, has been very successful in that endeavor. You know, all these spaceflight opportunities provide tremendous opportunities for students. So any space experiments I've had have had student involvement, either in designing the experiment, flying the experiment. I've had some masters and PhD students who've incorporated into their dissertations or theses. I've had undergraduates who have done undergraduate research. And, you know, as provost and as educator, I always like to mention the importance of student involvement in all my projects.
We've been speaking with John Z. Kiss. He's a plant-based biologist, professor, provost, and senior vice president for academic affairs at Florida Tech. John, thanks so much for giving us a spin with your experiment.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, even YouTube, really wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show. We're on social media, Instagram and Facebook. Our handle is AWTYSpace. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, shoot us an email, arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. More space coverage online, visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Allison Castillo. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.